If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Back in February 2020, we were joined on the podcast by the historian Frank McDonough to discuss the first volume of his History of the Third Reich, The Hitler Years, which ended after Germany's comprehensive military defeat of Poland in 1939. Since then, Frank has published the second volume of The Hitler Years, and that's what he's joining us to discuss today. Called Disaster, this volume considers the years 1940 to 45, charting how the Third Reich fell from the peak of its power in 1940 to Hitler's death and the disastrous Battle of Berlin. Putting the questions to Frank was our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
Fantastic. So thanks so much for joining us again, Frank, to talk about the latest volume of The Hitler Years.
Yes, it's nice to be here, the second part.
Yes. And we last year we began by talking about the chronological approach that you take to this history. But for those who are coming to this episode first or perhaps listeners new to the podcast, I hope we could start perhaps by talking a little bit about that approach again and the time that's covered in this second volume.
Well, when I thought about doing a general history of the Third Reich, because I've written so many other books on aspects of the Third Reich, it struck me that, you know, there'd never been a book that just covered the actual period 1933 to 45. Most of the other books had gone way back into Hitler's early life and making the emphasis on Hitler and the early Nazi party and the Weimar period. So I thought, I'll start it in 33 and end it in 1945. And many of the other books had been thematic. For example, Richard Evans's three-volume history had been thematic. He'd looked at different themes rather than going chronologically. The most famous chronological study is William Shirer's famous, you know, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, but that's largely out of date, really. And he didn't have access to most of the archives that became available, you know, after the 1960s. Then you've got the biographies, of course, which take a chronological approach as well. But again, we have to emphasize that they are biographies. People keep coming back and saying, oh, what about Ian Kershaw? Well, Ian Kershaw's book is a biography. This book is a history of the Third Reich. It's a history, therefore, of Germany in that period. So it's much more broader. It's not just focused on Hitler. So what I decided then was that it had to be comprehensive and different. And so I decided to call it the Hitler Years, with the emphasis on years. Every chapter in the book, volume one, covers the period 1933 to 1939, and that's called Triumph. And volume two covers the period 1940 to 1945, and that's called Disaster. And each chapter covers a year in detail, and it's chronological. You know, the book was planned. It was very heavily planned. The planning of the book took months because I had to construct a chronology of the whole period. So it goes into areas that you probably won't have heard of before because they're generated by the chronology. So the chronology led to the research, and then you build up the whole picture. I think, you know, people who read Volume 1 have said that they like it because, you know, you're getting a sense. If you're a general reader, I think it's great because you're not getting the kind of, you know, the academic sort of diversion of moving off into historiographical debates that you might not really understand, or the thematic way of looking at it, which is much more analytical the way you would approach it. And again, the general reader will probably, they probably won't be able to keep up with that. So with this, you know, I take you through the year, you know, in detail and in depth, really. And the first volume, as I said, ended. It didn't end like most of these. Most of these volumes, where they're split into two, stop in September. So what you get is 1933 to 1939. But it ends in September, and then the second volume starts in September as well. This one's different because this one ended, the last volume ended on New Year's Eve, 1939, with Hitler at the peak of his triumph, having just won in Poland.
So before we go into a bit more into the history in each of these years, could we talk a little bit more about, you know, as a historian who's written thematic books before, who's obviously very familiar with this history, what was it that, you know, did anything surprise you approaching it in this chronological storyboard way, or what did you take from this process?
I think really what it brought out, because I had to sort of bring in much more chronological detail, it started to emerge how much Hitler waited, you know, the time that he waited before the war, you know, to make his moves in foreign policy, and also to see that the meetings that he had with people were also crucial in the chronological framework. So it started me thinking about Hitler, the way that he operated, much more in the public persona and the private persona. So I looked at all of his speeches and I looked at all of the documents, the secret documents that he was talking to diplomats and stuff like that. So you get kind of two Hitlers, the public Hitler, which before the war is talking about peace quite a lot, not war. And then, you know, the private Hitler who actually wants war. And it's quite clear that he's moving towards a series of plans that are going to lead with a clash with Britain and France. So I think that came out much more clearly with this chronology than I'd realised before. I think that in the second volume, Hitler really can no longer have this public lie, if you like. He can no longer be sort of Dr. Jekyll anymore, because everybody knows that he's Mr. Hyde by now. So it really takes away a lot of the kind of surprise that he had before. Everyone now knows what he's up to. Everybody knows that he wants to dominate the world by force, and therefore what he says carries less weight with the Allies. The Allies aren't really interested in what he says. And even when, for example, after the defeat of Poland, he offers Britain and France a peace settlement. Peace settlement, he's just destroyed Poland. And this peace settlement, it's a great settlement for Hitler. As long as Britain and France, you know, accept you know, his defeat of Poland, then, and he'll guarantee the British Empire. But of course, he doesn't realise, you know, Britain can't allow Germany to dominate the whole of Europe in return for a false promise that he's going to protect the empire, because nobody believes that he'll keep any of his promises anymore. So I think he has a lot of sort of his usual way of operating taken away by the start of the war.
So with his usual way of operating, if we look at that separate from his ideology, I suppose, without being too simplistic, it often might be assumed that Hitler had this plan of expansion and ultimately this plan of this horrific genocide that was laid out from the beginning from his ideas laid out in Mein Kampf. But as your volume lays out, that this plan, grand plan, doesn't come together from that, does it?
I think what I try to show, and because it's shown in chronological detail, you can see that he does have a kind of, a kind of framework which he's working on. But of course, he's moved away from his framework, because if you go back to Mein Kampf, you know, his main aim in Mein Kampf is to get an alliance with Britain, which he never got, and also to actually destroy the Soviet Union and to gain territory in the Soviet Union. And at the start of 1940, he's got a pact with Stalin So he's actually in a pact with his biggest and most hated enemy. And he's fighting against someone, Britain, who he saw as a potential ally. So he's got the wrong, this is not the war that he wants. In other words, the events are shaping him and he has to react. He's got to react more to the events than he did before 1939, because A, the Allies are not going to believe, you know, any of his rhetoric anymore. And B, he's got an alliance, not an alliance, but it's more or less an agreement with the Soviet Union. You know, if he wants to attack the Soviet Union, he's going to have to get out of that agreement. And therefore, the events are key because they push Hitler into what he's going to do next now. So in other words, instead of being the mastermind of the event, the master, like almost like Alfred Hitchcock, he's no longer the director of the events. He's more of an actor. He's reacting to what's happening in the world. And we see that quite a lot. He tries still to have some kind of plan, but he does move around quite a bit.
And this plan, I mean, much has been made, I suppose, of his perhaps erratic decision-making. And in fact, after the war, a lot of people said his decisions were down to Germany losing the war. But as you say, that this isn't the whole picture.
No, I mean, what comes out in the book is that the generals, the generals who appeared at the Nuremberg trials, Hitler's generals, they gave a picture of the war which was wholly one-sided, which was they were very efficient. They knew exactly what was going on. They could have won the war had Hitler not meddled in their decisions and destroyed them. I suppose one of them was von Manstein. He wrote a book called Lost Victories. So by a title like that, you can tell that he thought Germany could win the war. And even at the Nuremberg trials, they kept saying, oh, we told him not to do this. Oh, we told him not to do that. But they went along with the attack on France, for example. They actually produced a detailed report which led to the attack on the Soviet Union. They also saw Slavs as second-class citizens. They shared his anti-Bolshevism as well. They were not against, you know, the atrocities that were going on in the Soviet Union, even though they tried to say they were not, they actually were. So I think in this book, you see that a lot of the decisions actually are collective decisions. Hitler doesn't make all the bad decisions. He sometimes makes good decisions. A good example of this is in the chapter on 1940. When in January 1940, a German reconnaissance plane crashes at a place called Mechelen, and the pilot on board has the plans for the attack on the West called Case Yellow. And in those original plans, the attack was going to go through Belgium and then on to France, similar to 1914. So Hitler then is faced, it's called the Mechelen incident. Hitler's now faced with, maybe he thinks we need to change this plan. And von Manstein, he comes up with a plan, a different plan. He says, well, now the Allies know that we're going to attack through Belgium. Let's attack through Belgium, but make it a diversion to another attack. And he suggests something very bold, which is to go through the Ardennes Forest, bridge the River Meuse, and then travel using tanks as the spearhead all the way to Dunkirk. And that plan comes off, and Hitler adopts that plan. Now, von Manstein actually was more or less, he was furloughed after the attack on Poland. He was kept to the sidelines because his ideas were seen as too radical. He produced a number of memoranda suggesting this plan, and all the generals, the leading generals, said, oh, it won't work. It won't work. You know, if we don't bridge the River Meuse, then we're finished. And he said, the Allies will know that we're going to go that way. And if they use their aircraft, they can destroy us getting across the river. But eventually he goes for that plan. Now that plan pays off and it wins the Battle of France. So that's where Hitler gambles on a plan that grew out of this, what we said before. He didn't plan all this. The fact that the aeroplane went down and the plans came into the possession of the Belgians and then the Allies, he had to change the plan. So you see, Hitler, pretty good there at improvising. He improvised quite well, still carrying on what he'd done before the war started. So there you have the first victory in a way, it's a tactical victory. It's not a military overwhelming victory. It's a tactical victory.
So these decisions then, however they can be characterised or judged, he's very, very focused on the military activity on all of the fronts that emerge throughout this conflict. What's happening on the domestic side of things? How involved is he there?
He's not involved at all. In fact, you know, domestically, he takes hardly any interest in what's going on domestically. So what happens is the individual ministers and ministries, they start taking their own decisions. The individual Gauleiters, they also start taking their own decisions as well. The local Nazi parties, they also start taking their own decisions. So what you've got is kind of two wars. Hitler obsessed with the military planning and staying in his, you know, he has this military headquarters at Rastenburg, which is in East Prussia, and he stays there. He does move to another military headquarters at Vinnitsia for a brief period, but he's mostly in this military headquarters there for most of the war. He spends very little time in Berlin, and he gives less and less speeches. And as we know, speech making was one of the greatest ways that he built up his popularity. So the German public have a kind of figure who's a bit remote now. He's more remote. He's not out there. He's not present at the government center in Berlin. He's not taking the major decisions. I think something like 90% of all the ministerial decrees, Hitler didn't even sign them. They came from those ministries. So what you've got, a home, you've got kind of administrative chaos at home, which Hitler is not coordinating. He wasn't coordinating government before the war because he got rid of things like the cabinet. And that becomes a problem as the war emerges, with Hitler, you know, being pressed by people like Goebbels and Goering to take more interest in the home front. And he's not really interested in the home front. He's obsessed by the war. War becomes an addiction for Hitler. In a way, I think this is the point that I make about Hitler. Hitler wants to win the battles as they come up, but he doesn't have any real long-term strategy of what he's going to do. It's like a kind of expansion without any objective. What's the overall objective? He doesn't ever seem to outline what the overall objective is. He just carries on from one set of events to another set of events, one sort of plan to another plan. I mean, he does exhaust the first plan before moving on to the next plan, but then you're not sure, you're never sure what is the aim.
Which is pretty at odds with that idea of a master plan laid out in the 1920s.
Exactly. I mean, this is where the idea of him as a master planner falls down. It falls down over a master planner is surely not indecisive. I mean, it's like going on holiday as a child with your dad. This probably did happen, that he was driving the car and he thought, where shall we go today? And then everyone in the car says, let's go here, let's go there. And he's going, oh, I don't know, where shall I go? And there's a little bit of that about Hitler. There's a little bit of that indecisiveness about him. Even though, of course, we see him as this clear-minded dictator, but in the way that he carries out the decisions, there's a lot of kind of indecision, and he will shift from one position to another.
If we can go back to this, the point about devolution and delegation you just raised with the Gauleiters and things like that, one thing that comes out in your account is that obviously, the final solution, while it was driven by Hitler's ideologies, his racism, the process, if that's the right word, of the final solution was not driven by Hitler. It was driven by many, many of those below him.
Well, I think in this volume, as you will have noted having read it, is that there's a hell of a lot on the Jewish question and the final solution. You know, that is a big part of this volume, about what goes on. And what comes over is that, you know, Hitler is a kind of shadowy figure. You know, sometimes we see him getting details from Goebbels, don't we? Sometimes Himmler, he talks briefly to Himmler. Sometimes he makes a speech where he's very anti-Jewish in the speech. But the actual minutiae of the policy is devolved. It's devolved down to Himmler and his SS empire and Heydrich and others. So in other words, you know, down to the local people on the spot, the men on the spot, really, in Poland and the Soviet Union, and they seem to take their own initiatives. And so what we've got here is a situation which is similar to the way that the Nazi system works. There's a lot of devolvement of power to individuals, and those individuals feel as though they can make enormous decisions. A lot of enormous decisions seem to, I would say, evolve. They seem to evolve. It seems as though we're moving towards, you know, genocide against the Jews, but it's not coordinated. Then it starts to catch up to be coordinated. I suppose the Wannsee Conference in January 1942, and that chapter sort of covers that period. It's called War on the Jews. And then it shows how closely after that come these extermination camps at Treblinka, Sobibor and Belzec. And that's called Operation Reinhard. And interestingly enough, you know, 1942 is when all the killing of the Jews happens. Most of it happens in 1942. The biggest bulk happens then. But with Hitler, you only see it through speeches that he makes. You don't see him heavily involved. You also realise, you know, Goebbels only catches up with Wannsee maybe 6 or 7 weeks later. You know, there's no direct letter going to him. He obviously sees the minutes because we can see in his diary he starts to talk about it. So, and we can see from Hitler that he becomes very obsessed, can't we? As the book develops, we see Hitler becoming more publicly obsessed with the anti-Semitism issue. So I try to show that the final solution wasn't just something that was dictated by Hitler from above as a kind of, you know, an order that then followed directly to people. I show that it developed, you know, it developed more organically from below. And from the devolution of power to people, this was the thing about the Nazi system, that it devolved power to people who then thought they had tons and tons of power themselves. And there's a famous phrase, I think Ian Kershaw used it, that they work towards the Führer. But in a way, when you actually look at the decisions they take, there's no way that they can be working towards the Führer. They're working towards their own problem solving in a particular instance. And it may not be linked to ideology. It may be just, look, this ghetto is full. We need to get rid of some people from this ghetto. And someone says, yeah, we could take them to a small place outside called Chelmno, and maybe we could gas some people. And that becomes a solution to what is, in effect, an overcrowding problem. It's not like where they sit down and say, we must exterminate these Jews. It's that there's too many Jews here. We can't feed them. What do we do? And these are the problems, as we see with the mass shooting in the Soviet Union. It starts out as mass shooting, and then Himmler visits one of these mass shootings in Minsk, and he starts to say he's not worried about the victims. He's worried about the psychological effect on the men who are carrying out the machine gunning of all these victims, and says we must find a more humane way of doing it. Not more humane for the victims, but more humane for the perpetrators. And then we get towards, don't we, the extermination camp. And even in the extermination camps, there's no one system about how to kill people. You know, you have at Auschwitz-Birkenau, you have Cyclone B is used, but not exclusively. Carbon monoxide is also used. And at these other extermination camps, it's normally a carbon monoxide engine that pipes in the gas that kills them. So it's not like a uniform way of doing things. I also show, and I think this is something new, is how much that the Holocaust was done on the cheap. That really it was all very much a cost-cutting exercise. It wasn't actually, you know, organized by a government department. They didn't have tons and tons of money. It was actually supposed to be self-financing. And that was to be financed from the victims by taking their valuables, also by some of the prisoners they got off the trains who will be used as these Sonderkommando to do all the dirty work, and very little SS personnel. At a place like Treblinka, you've only got 20 SS salaried men running a camp that kills a million people by outsourcing to all these different people. For example, they recruit Ukrainian guards into those extermination camps.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I think, you know, we can, looking at it through the Western way of looking at the war, we can end up, you know, with, you know, Tom Hanks wins the war. Or we can end up with the Western idea of the war where you know, you have a whole celebration of the period of the war, and you don't even mention the Soviet Union.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down. And learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
I mean, the incremental steps towards this horror laid out in the way it is very, very, very chilling. And you just mentioned it in your answer there of the horrors that happened more broadly on the Eastern Front, on the war in the East. There were obviously these two different fronts that Hitler was fighting on, at various points during the war. One was much more ideologically important to him than the other.
Yes, I mean, I think that, you know, what I make clear is that there really are, you've got to see Germany's war as two different wars, really. You know, there's the war that goes on with the Western Allies, and that's fought, you know, on the Geneva Convention principles. I mean, I know that you can laugh about the Great Escape and about, you know, the arguments over the chocolate and Richard Attenborough saying, we haven't got our chocolate and where's our coffee and all of that kind of thing. But in actual fact, it's not very far from the truth because, you know, over 98% of British prisoners of war came home, whereas only 13% of Soviet prisoners of war made it home. And they were starved and they weren't given Red Cross parcels. There was no Red Cross parcels. The Geneva Convention wasn't applied to the Soviet Union on the basis that the Soviet Unions themselves hadn't signed the Geneva Convention. But of course, Germany had signed the Geneva Convention and was also bound by it. And that came out of the Nuremberg trial. So that was a fallacious argument to say that they weren't bound. And in the West, you know, there was kind of more nobility in the West. The soldiers in the West, when the soldiers of the West talk about the war, they talk in respectful terms about the Germans. You know, they're not horrific people who come into the town, take all the women and children to the edge of town and then get them to dig a big pit and mow them down with machine guns. That doesn't happen in the West. You see the difference just purely in the use of, say, something like flamethrowers, used massively in the attack on the Soviet Union in the German-Soviet war, but used very sparingly in the West and not against civilians. And we don't see the same, there's not the same order to get all the civilians and kill them in the West. We don't see that at all. In Africa, it's a kind of, you know, it's almost like a nice cricket match, really. You know, and we have Rommel. You know, Rommel comes out of the war quite well because he was one of the few German generals, you know, who didn't engage in atrocities because he wasn't on the Eastern Front. Of course, you know, had he been on the Eastern Front, I'm pretty sure he would have sanctioned atrocities. I think we sort of give this idea that because he wasn't there, you know, that he wouldn't have sanctioned atrocities, whereas all the generals who were on the Eastern Front did, who were very similar to him, and in fact, who knew him quite well. So I think we do have two wars, and it's much more brutal. I mean, I think that when you look at the two conflicts, I mean, some of the battles on that Eastern Front, the brutality on both sides, it's like the Wild West. And it's not just that the Germans are awful, but the Soviets are willing to be awful as well. So we have on both sides, we have instances of rape. And towards the end, we have lots of instances of the Soviet Red Army engaging in rape. And we have instances as well, don't we, with the German army, you know, of mass executions as they go into these towns. And even later in the war, they operate a scorched earth policy as well, which they don't do in the West. So yes, there are two wars, and I try to, you know, give equal treatment to the two wars so that you can see the differences in brutality between them.
Yes, and I think those stark differences in the brutality and the way in which they were fought. I was really interested about the idea of reappraising the significance of events. I think you say that certainly in a British, in terms of British or American views of popular history, D-Day takes massive significance. Yet at that time, Hitler was very much focused on the Eastern Front, not there for him.
I think, you know, we can, looking through the Western way of looking at the war, we can end up, you know, with, you know, Tom Hanks wins the war. Or we can end up with the Western idea of the war where, you know, you have a whole celebration of the period of the war. And you don't even mention the Soviet Union. And the differences in the casualty rates are absolutely enormous between the numbers that die on the Eastern Front and the numbers that die on the Western Front, and even for the Germans themselves. I mean, I think I mentioned, you know, the 4 out of every 5 German soldiers who were killed by a soldier of the Red Army. And I think, yeah, Hitler started the end of 1943, he started to realise that the Western theatre of the war was going to become more important, although he didn't really prepare enough for the potential attack in the West, as he should have done. And also because German intelligence, which actually operated very poorly, German intelligence, you know, didn't spot the D-Day landing. You know, German intelligence didn't spot the Battle of Kursk. You know, German intelligence was very poor in Stalingrad and in Operation Uranus, which was the amazing Soviet encirclement of German troops around Stalingrad, and German intelligence didn't spot that. So German intelligence was very poor. I think what I try to show is, yes, the Allied contribution, it was an alliance. I mean, I do make that quite clear, that it was an alliance, and we need to bring in the Soviet dimension, because without the Soviet dimension and just having books that look at the West, then we don't see how big the war in the East was. And I think in this book, you can actually look, for example, I show all of the detail of the D-Day landings in great depth and the Battle of France, but I also show in enormous detail Operation Bagration, which is the huge Soviet attack that takes place 3 weeks after the D-Day landing. And it's a huge attack. It pushes the German army back 300 miles. It destroys Army Group Center, which many would say is the greatest army grouping of the German army. And it really, you know, by the end of you know, sort of August 1944, the Russians are at one side of the Volga. They've moved that far, whereas the British and the Americans haven't got over the Rhine yet. So you can see that I try to show the two wars. And also, I also show probably... you know, for the British reader, that the Americans actually, as you can see from the latter part of the book, it's actually the Americans who make the big breakthrough, isn't it, after the D-Day landing. And they also make the big breakthrough over the bridge at Remagen, and then they make the big breakthrough, don't they, all the way. And they get Montgomery and they send him, don't they, to Hamburg, sort of pension him off in a way. And I think that was quite interesting to see how much the Americans, I show how the Americans start to learn about war. And in a way, the Americans and the Soviets are similar in the war, I think. The Soviets start to learn about war as the war goes on and start to get better at it. And then they start to get better at strategy. And it's same with the Americans, you know, in North Africa, they're hopeless. And even the British say they're terrible, you know. But gradually, even in Italy, they don't perform much better. But then after the D-Day landing and after the amazing breakout from the bridgehead, and then the movement that won the Battle of France after the Falaise Pocket. You know, it's the Americans who make the big, you know, the big move. You know, Omar Bradley, the American commander, you know, he could say, he didn't want to rub it into Montgomery, did he? But let's face it, he actually makes the big move that wins the Battle of France. So I do try to show the two wars as they go on and develop. And I think, you know, this is what made it really difficult to write, I've got to say, to you now, you know, trying to hold all these events together is really, really difficult because, you know, you've got to move from North Africa through to Russia, over to the Western Front, Hitler's own, you know, the bomb plot in 1944, you know, you've got an amazing a lot of, you know, and the bomb attacks. There's a lot of detail there as well about the bomb attacks on Germany and how the German people reacted to those bomb attacks. You know, there's a lot on Hamburg attacks, isn't there? There's also a lot on the Berlin attacks and, of course, Dresden. So I tried to create this big panorama, really, in which the reader can actually start to make judgments as well. Because, you know, I don't like that kind of writing that sort of tells you what to think. I like to sort of lay it out so you say, look at the details here, look at the statistics, and then, you know, and then make up your own mind here. If you're being driven through that kind of narrative, you can do that, you know, the kind of analytical. I would see it. I think my book is not a story, it's a narrative. With explanation and interpretation. So I'm interpreting what's happening all the time. I'm being a historian all the time. But I think the reader themselves can glean from this what they think about the events and how it's developing in that way.
And you do write that contrary to perhaps a popular belief, historical knowledge of this period of the Third Reich, it isn't complete. And there are new sources emerging, have emerged since big narrative histories before and will. Why do you think there's such a pervasive opinion that we know everything we need to know?
I don't blame you, because you're doing a great job there at History Extra. I blame, you know, things like the History Channel, these sort of very simplistic narratives that go in these programmes. You've even got programmes as well that try to say Hitler, you know, survived the war. So you've got conspiracy theories coming into it. You've got people who don't accept the Holocaust, Holocaust deniers. I think this sort of pernicious Hitlerism, where, you know, Hitler-centric view of the war, everything was Hitler. And then so there's no place, is there? There's no place for Operation Bagration. Tell me a BBC One documentary or BBC Two documentary about the German-Soviet war. I've never seen one. You know, I've never seen one. And if you do see one on the History Channel, it's so puerile and, you know, that they can't be bothered to get anybody in to do some kind of research on it. So what do they do? Well, it's easier, isn't it, to take the original narrative, you know, find 10 talking heads and tell the same story. I mean, I've been in these, I mean, I shouldn't say this, but I've been in these programs and then I say to them things like, you know, why don't you look at this? Why don't you look at that? And they say, oh, but that's too complex. The audience don't want that. You know, the minute you start to say maybe Hitler wasn't as sort of dominant as you think, and maybe that he was more of a vacillating figure, and maybe that he just went to pieces. They don't want to know that, you see. So I blame that. I think that it's that narrative that's the problem that we've got in history. We've almost got a Hitler sort of Hitler-centric channel and a Hitler-centric group of sort of histories that are sort of just concentrating on him.
The focus shifts in 1943-44, and we begin to see this decline and Hitler's loss of control, his retreat. What can you say about this period and its relevance?
I think what we start to see in the latter part of the book, especially, you know, 1945, the chapter is called Funeral in Berlin. And we start to see that Hitler, in spite of what people have said, you know, Hitler didn't really know what was coming. There's a great little sort of discussion he has with his secretary, isn't there? You know, where she says, you know, what do you think is going to happen to National Socialism? And he says, it's finished. you know, it won't come back. If it comes back, he said, it won't be the same and it might not come back for 100 years. Now, there's a man who kind of, you can see that when he's sort of a bit loose at Hitler, maybe he tells the truth. And I think there he does tell the truth, that really he thinks the game is up. And then we see Goebbels starting to suggest to him, you know, why don't we broker a peace settlement with Stalin? And then he says, why is he going to want a peace? And he's quite clear-headed about it. He says, why is he going to want a peace settlement with me when he's winning the war? And he said, as for Roosevelt and Churchill, there's no chance that they're going to have a peace settlement with me. They've been spent the whole war attacking me. They're hardly likely, you know, they have to think about their public opinion more. And then we see him gradually, don't we, disintegrating in his health, and he ends up, doesn't he, in the bunker. And I suppose then, you know, you could say that, you know, he won't face up to his defeat, but in a way he sort of, you know, we have recent examples of people who are finding it difficult to facing up to defeat, no names here, but what we see with Hitler is he gradually does accept that, you know, his defeat's going to come and that the Allies are going to, you know, the Red Army is going to come in to the bunker and probably will arrest him, and he doesn't want that to happen. So I suppose it's his last will and testament, I think, is very interesting. And there's a great part of the book where Traudel Jung describes, you know, the actual moment when Hitler comes to her office to dictate the final will and testament. And she says, here I was. What a person to be in history. Here I am in front of a typewriter waiting to have dictated the explanation of why Germany went to war. And she said she waited for him to say, and he said, it wasn't my fault. She said, that's what he said. Those were his first words. I didn't want this war. It was caused by these Jewish conspirators, he said, who control Britain and control France. And he said, then they control Stalin and they control Roosevelt. And the Jewish conspiracy control the whole thing. They caused the war. I was trying to do something for humanity by getting rid of the Jews. So right to the end, we kind of then, we've been talking, haven't we, throughout this talk about the plan, what was the plan, but we've missed something, I think, all the way through our discussion of Hitler, is what was his essence? What was his real essence? And yes, it was war. He was addicted to war, but in a way that was his kind of recreation, wasn't it? That was his drug of choice, if you like. But what was his essence? Anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism, as this book shows, is Hitler's true ideological core. And that's what we need to accept and understand. And of course, now in the modern world, it's very important that this is brought out even more clearly.
That was Frank McDonough. The Hitler Years, Disaster 1940-45, is published in the UK by Head of Zeus and is available now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back tomorrow when David Hepworth will be speaking about the Beatles in America.